Today is the beginning of a new month, and so we're going to the mailbag next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to this 1st of November edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is my Vice Chairman, good friend, technical advisor, constitutional historian, and yes, postmaster, Chuck Michaels.
Yeah, well, I'm very glad to be here, and we're again coming to you by the miracle of Skype. We're going to go back to our discussion on the Reformation and its effect on culture tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right, ladies and gentlemen, because what we're trying to develop here, and since we just started this program with you last month, we didn't have any mail in our mailbag yet, but over the last couple of weeks, as we've had these programs, we've had some listeners go to our webpage at principledpolicy.com, and you can do that as well, and comment on the things that you're hearing coming from the Principles and Policies radio program. You pointed out to me that we had mail, so that's the reason why I'm calling you our postmaster. And I was really pretty impressed, because we've got some folks out there who have taken some time and they're thinking through these things. They're hearing, they're digesting, they're pushing back a little bit as well. And that really, ladies and gentlemen, is what we want to have happen. We want to have interaction with you, the listening audience. I mean, hey, if you just want to email us, now, you know, obviously keep it clean, keep it respectful. And if you want to say, well, hey, you guys are just, you're way off your rockers here, that's fine. Go ahead and email it to us. If you want to say, hey, right on, you hit it on the head, well, we like that too, because, hey, everybody likes praise. But we want to go today because we had a couple here, and we thought these were some good comments for us to think about on a couple of the issues we've talked about on the program so far during the month of October. And the first one, Chuck, we're going to go to is from our commentator who gave us some questions and some thoughts about our podcast of the 14th on the issue of the execution of Anwar al-Awlaki, the American citizen who had defected to al-Qaeda, who was taken out by a CIA drone plane in an assassination. And under our program, was al-Awlaki's sentence correct? Our respondent here said, first of all, he said, thanks for the great analysis. But then he asked some questions, and I appreciated these questions. And he said, would al-Awlaki have to have been tried in court before letters of mark and reprisal could be granted against him? If not, then how can a letter of mark and reprisal not be a bill of attainder? And I'm turning to our constitutional student, teacher, Chuck, because I think you've thought about
that. Yeah, I have. The answer is, first of all, the reason that letters of mark and reprisal are issued is precisely because a person can't be tried in court for these issues. For instance, this was really designed to handle things like piracy. And a guy like Anwar al-Awlaki was essentially a pirate. He was a person operating outside the bounds of law and being harbored by a foreign state. And because there was no redress available in the courts and he was unavailable for trial, you really can't try someone in absentia, because at that point you have denied him the right to face his accuser, which is a right guaranteed by the United States Constitution.
Exactly.
To someone tried in the United States. Now, I understand the question, how can a letter of mark and reprisal not be a bill of attainder? And the answer is, because a bill of attainder is a finding of treason. A letter of mark and reprisal is a mere finding of fact that some kind of a crime with damages has been committed, and it's an attempt to A, recover the damage, and B, possibly, if possible, capture the person so that they can be tried in a court of law. And then he can be attainted, because if he has committed an act of war against his own country, he has definitely given aid and comfort to the enemies of his nation.
Mm-hmm.
And,
that's right.
And therefore, he could be indicted and tried and attainted, but not by Congress. He would have to be attainted by a court. Only a court can attaint you, and an attainder is a finding of guilt of treason.
Well, our correspondent then asked another set of questions, probably and maybe anticipating that answer you just gave. And he says, do bills of attainder, habeas corpus, and due process rights apply to non-citizens? And if so, under what circumstance? And then he says, is treason by definition something that can only be committed by citizens?
Well, the last part first. The answer to that is a very clear yes, because a foreign national is not loyal to the sovereignty of the United States.
And that's a very good answer, Chuck. That's right. You have to be a citizen of the country to be committing treason against them. Anything else would be considered either an international crime or, as we call it today, terrorism.
Yes. And by the way, just so everybody knows, you cannot have a war on terrorism. It's the most absurd notion. Terrorism is a battle tactic.
Yeah, it's a tactic.
You can no more declare war on a battle tactic for like terrorism than you can declare war on the cavalry charge.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and honestly, we wouldn't declare war on a cavalry charge anyway, because we might actually be arrested for animal cruelty.
Well, that's true. Now, we're going to have to short shrift that, and we may get back to that at some point. But let's go back to the thing, do the bills of attainder, habeas corpus, and due process rights apply to non-citizens? And the answer is only within the jurisdiction of the United States.
Aha. So if that person would then be outside the jurisdiction, i.e. or expatriate themselves,
yes,
then those rights, they couldn't claim those rights.
In other words, if the person is under arrest in the United States and he's within the jurisdiction here, you know, one of the courts, and now a bill of attainder really wouldn't apply to a non-citizen.
Right.
Because for the same reason we just went over, and the fact is an attainder is a treason, and that person, if he's a foreign national, cannot be attainted. That it's a non sequitur. It just really doesn't apply at all. Now, habeas corpus and due process rights are not simply there for American citizens. They apply to everyone. The reason they're in the Constitution is because it's a basic right that every person has.
Now, so it's some a human foreign, right.
That's right. Well, I don't like that word because it implies a social contract for the derivation of rights. Wrong. Rights come from God. They're guaranteed by governments, not given to them by them.
That's a very good clarification. See, this is the reason why we have Chuck on the board at the Institute for Principal Policy, because he can cut right to it, and even when the director can't seem to see it clearly, we can go to Chuck for the constitutional answer. Now, our correspondent here, Chuck, just to continue to go on with this a little bit. Our correspondent then opined here, says, it seems to me that if war had been declared, then by definition, none of these protective rights would apply to the declared enemy. Otherwise, the power to declare war would be utterly useless. Locke defined war as a conflict over which no earthly judge has the authority to resolve, and therefore the only way for justice to be attained is for the injured party to take the law into his own hands. Well, you know, that strikes me as that seems to be vigilante justice.
There are accepted, I hate to say this, because in some cases, you know, war, there aren't really no rules, but there are. There are accepted international rules of law, of the way wars are supposed to be conducted. Now, one of those things is a fair treatment of prisoners of war. Now, one of the problems we're going to run into here is that while the guy we killed.
That's right.
He was acting as a combatant, but he was acting as what would be known today as a privateer or a pirate. Mm-hmm. And he was under the protection of a government. Okay.
Well, there is
no war declared.
Aha. And that's the reason why I wanted to go here, because our correspondent wrote this, and I think you're getting it answering this right now. He says, therefore, it doesn't make sense to say that a judge must make a ruling in order for an enemy combatant to be killed, captured, or held, even indefinitely, once a war has been declared. But presumably, these constitutional prohibitions, and I would call them protections, imply that the United States can't declare war on its own citizens.
And I think
he just got to where he's understanding it.
Yes. You can't declare war on an American citizen. Now, an American citizen can commit an act of war against the United States, in which case he has committed treason. But the fact is that Al-Awlaki was under the protection of a foreign government. That made his act of war by proxy an act of war by that nation. Now, are we declaring war against that nation? No. So this is why the letter of mark and reprisal comes in, because they don't want to go to a war situation. So what Congress could have done was issued a letter of mark and reprisal, and then you can do a military action short of war to do your best to try to recover damages or to capture the person to bring them back for trial.
Okay. Well, and I think our correspondent thought about this, because he said, are letters of mark and reprisal a type of war under Locke's definition, or is it merely declaring a means by which due process may be carried out? And I think that's what you're getting at, is it's a means to carry out due process.
Well,
if the person is beyond the reach of the courts by expatriating themselves, a letter of mark, it would be to go and get that person and bring them back so that they may stand as an American citizen for their overtly treasonous acts against their own country.
If possible, but if not possible, then it's also acceptable to attempt to declare damages in lieu of the fact that there will be no due process. There will be no court case because there's no one to sue. If you try to sue the government that was harboring Al-Awlaki, good luck getting them to show up in a United States court.
There's truth to that.
They're not going to come. And we can play these games, well, we'll go before the international court. Yeah, right. There is no such thing as an international court. They've got one established. Nobody pays it any heed because it has no authority. And some people will squawk at that. Sorry, there is no such thing as an international court. There are agreements between nations by treaty, and there are tacit agreements by things that are less than treaty. And the fact is that there are bad players and there are good players, and the country that was keeping Al-Awlaki under protection is a bad player. And therefore, the United States could have issued a letter of mark and reprisal and said, we're coming to get him, and we are going to recover some damages for the people who have been harmed by the fact that you've been harboring this man.
Okay, so I hope that our correspondent hears this or gets our podcast.
Unfortunately, we're going to run out of time, but one other point I want to make is that where you have to go to get this kind of information is where the founders went for all the stuff having to do with what they called the law of nations.
Yes.
And the largest person wasn't Locke on this. Locke was a great their great source on human rights in general. And again, that word human rights, but rights in general. But they went to Emmerich de Vattel, who was a Swiss expert on the law of nations.
That's right. That's right.
We brought that up in that earlier broadcast. That's where you have to go to get all, basically your thinking straightened around on the law of nations and how nations interact.
So your marching orders today, ladies and gentlemen, are read Vattel and continue to listen to Principles and Policies. We'll be back tomorrow at 5:30, continuing our series on why the Reformation is important to America today. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back tomorrow.
And now, here's a constitutional moment with the Institute on the Constitution's Michael Perutka.
Are you an American? If you are, can I ask you a question? In your way of thinking, what makes you an American? Is it where you were born or where you live? Does a Social Security number make you an American, or a passport or a driver's license? If we think back to when America began, what made you an American back then? Was it geography that drew our founders together in a struggle to free themselves from the tyranny of King George III? I don't think so. The words of the founders themselves suggest something else. Could it be that the men who formed the Declaration Committee gave us a clue in the very document they drafted? Well, I think so. What brought them together and unified their resolve to risk their lives and fortunes and stake their honor was what they believed. What made them Americans was their common faith and the commitment to act boldly on that faith. What were the tenets of that faith as expressed in the Declaration? Well, for them, it came down to three basic points. They said, there is a God, a creator God. They said, our rights come from Him. And they said, the purpose of government is to protect and defend these God-given rights. This is the faith of our fathers and its application to government. It's what made them Americans. Now let me ask you, are our current leaders in government Americans? Do they believe these things, and are they committed to act on these beliefs? and allow me to challenge you once again. Are you an American? This is Michael Anthony Peruca for Institute on the Constitution, bringing you The American View.